Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news this morning, I'm going to explain why these things are happening. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through His Torah, which means teaching, not law, and by way of His covenant. If you're rational, I expect this will be the most rewarding part of today's program. Anytime during today's discussion, we encourage you to participate. Our number is 877-300-7645. As I listened to the news this morning and heard all of the rhetoric coming out of both camps regarding Medicare, it had two reactions. One is, this is my least favorite time of year. As we approach the voting season in America, the number of idiotic, errant, misleading, beguiling, counterproductive commercials that are aired by both parties and the hot air that they spew is just so revolting. Now, here's the truth about Medicare. Obama is not cutting Medicare. He's increasing it radically. His plan was to add 50% more participants. But clever as Obama is, recognizing that we have a $1.5 trillion annual deficit, adding to our $15 trillion deficit. What he did is said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do is we'll add to the part of Medicare that is funded by the states so that the states pick up the burden and it doesn't look so bad for the federal government. But because most states are going bankrupt, we'll have a transition plan where the first year the feds pick up a significant part of the 50% increase in participants, and the second year they pick up a lesser percentage, and ultimately the entire burden goes to the states, which the states that are already teetering on bankruptcy, it is the last straw. It's why the majority of states sued the federal government on Obamacare, saying that it was outside the auspices of the federal government to impose this upon them. And that's when Chief Justice Roberts decided, you know, rather than ruling on the law, because clearly it isn't constitutional, I'll rewrite the law so that it fits my view of the Constitution. So here's the reality. Between the three aspects of the federal government, we spend some 75% of the total budget. It is on two principal Ponzi schemes. One is Social Security. We put Madoff in prison for running that kind of a scheme. It's a Ponzi scheme. Social Security, bankrupt system. Medicare and Medicaid, bankrupt systems. They are Ponzi schemes. Those are the largest two burdens of the federal government. Huge unfunded mandates. And the third is our military. Now, if you do not radically cut to those three things, then our deficits are going to continue to soar, and ultimately, in a not too distant future, the nation will collapse. It is inevitable. It cannot be stopped. We're at over 100% of GDP right now. That is way beyond the tipping point where it is catastrophic. It is a death spiral that we have entered, and we will continue to add to the deficit until we radically diminish Social Security and Medicare. As well as the defense budget. They all have to be reduced in the range of 50% if we wish to stop adding to the federal deficit. If we wish to reduce the federal deficit and over a period of 10 to 15 years take it down to zero, which would be the moral thing to do, particularly for our children, then we'd have to reduce them, these three aspects of government, the big three, by as much as 70%. So when you hear politicians on both sides of the aisle telling voters that we're not going to cut Medicare, we're not going to cut Social Security, what they are saying is that we're going to continue to bankrupt this nation so that there is nothing left for anyone because we cannot continue to do what we are doing. But that is the sad reality, and yet the rhetoric on both sides is we know that the majority of voters wish to continue to have this nation engage in economic pedophilia, where we indulge ourselves and we pass the burden, the cost of our indulgence onto our children. But it is not sustainable, and this kind of rhetoric, pointing the fingers at both sides dishonestly, without dealing with the problem, says that it does not matter who you vote for. There isn't a lesser of two evils in this particular election. The other thing that struck me is, and Scott and I were talking about it during the news itself, is that he made the comment that wouldn't it be nice if we could hold presidential candidates and congressmen and senators accountable for what they said they were going to do before they were elected, so that when they run for re-election, they would be matched against what they promised. With Obama, there were three principal promises of his election campaign. And you could probably extrapolate it to four. The first of those was he was condemning of our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and said that he, as president, would end those wars. We are still fighting in Iraq. He actually increased the number of troops in Afghanistan, increased the number of troops in Afghanistan, and he has engaged the United States in the civil war in Libya, and now is engaging the United States in the civil war in Syria. Rather than honoring those promises, he has exacerbated our situation. And his other big claim was that he was going to be the energy president. He was going to increase America's use of clean coal. He was going to increase drilling off the coast and make America energy independent while we created incentives for companies to invest in solar and wind power. And in fact, none of that has happened. In fact, his administration has been the principal obstacle to those things occurring, particularly in wind generation, incentives for solar generation, the Keystone Pipeline that they have fought against, fracking, which is a extremely effective means of making this nation energy independent, shale oil production, you name it, he has been opposed to it. In other words, his deeds have been the opposite of his words. He promised that he would be the president of change, and yet no president has hired more retreads from prior administrations than this president. He did exactly the opposite. And rather than changing America's course, he accelerated our movement in the same direction. All he did is hold the steering wheel straight and push down the accelerator, exacerbating our problems and accelerating the time of America's financial collapse. Lastly, he was going to be the president that was going to put America back to work, which seemed pretty stupid since the man had never worked a day in his life in business. But yet this man, who had never even received a paycheck from any business, was going to be the man who was going to resolve the issues of business. And then he, and his most recent State of the Union address, tells America that he wants to run the U.S. economy the way that the U.S. military is run, which is command and control, which means that he's really not a socialist. He's a communist. And so there you go. You have a president who has failed on all of his significant promises, and so he has changed his campaign theme from change we can believe in to forward. And you have an opponent who can't articulate any of this, can't hold him accountable, is incapable of differentiating himself.
Which is actually kind of weird, because he is a successful businessman. I mean, you'd think at some point he had to be in a board meeting or something to, you know, to get it out to people, you know, hey, here's my ideas, here's what we should go with.
You know, Scott, I've thought about that. How is it possible that he could have made so much money and seem to have so little grasp of what drives the American economy and American business? You know, the American people have been told that corporations are bad, and yet without corporations, there is no America. I mean, corporations pay all of the bills, all of the bills. It's either through their things that they make, or the people that they hire, and the taxes they pay, and the taxes that are paid on the people that they pay, that make everything in this country possible. And yet we have created an atmosphere where corporations, the very thing that makes America possible, are bad. And yet, so what is it about Romney that he could have made so much money and be so ill-advised about business? And what it struck me is that, well, I was in business for many years and was an entrepreneur. I started companies, I built them. As an entrepreneur, I was constantly required to meet with and talk to and engage with finance kinds of institutions and investment bankers. And what you find, and Romney was an investment banker. He raised capital various places around the world to buy companies, and then he put together a team that would go in and try to turn around a troubled business. He was never an entrepreneur. He was never a guy that built a business. He was a guy that bought troubled businesses and had other people then try to turn them around, and did so with other people's money. My experience with investment bankers is that very few of them know much about business. And so while they're typically well-educated in school, I also found that that those with MBAs, particularly Harvard MBAs, were the least capable of being effective in a business environment. And so my sense is that he also has never been in a business. He has never tried to build a business. He has never run a business. And as such, the only business that he knows is investment banking. And investment banking is playing with money. It's not about building something. It's not about making something. It's not about delivering value. It is all about playing with money. It's when Enron went from, for example, being an energy company to a company that played with money to try to create the illusion of profit, is when they failed. GE, for example, here not too long ago had to show losses in the tens of billions of dollars because they started emphasizing GE Capital, who was playing with money, as opposed to GE Aviation, who was building engines. And when you make that kind of transition, you lose track of what really matters. And that's my only answer for why Romney can't effectively convey what's needed in this country, nor seems to be able to expose the failings of this current president. This is Shattering Myths. We hope that you give us a call, 877-300-7645. Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics. During the break, Scott and I continue to talk about this anomaly, how it is possible that Obama has managed to turn his most egregious liability, his most horrible failure, against the strength of Romney, and prevail with a very significant number of people. Romney's lead in the polls has increased substantially since Obama has focused on Bain Capital. And think about this. Now, one of the issues was on tax. Now, he has this commercial that he runs and said, you know, most of you pay more than the 14% tax that Romney paid last year. He made $20 million, and they only paid 14% in tax. Well, fact is that majority of Americans pay nothing in tax. So the very premise of the commercial is a lie. Most Americans pay nothing in tax. It's between 50 and 51% that collectively pay nothing. The top 10% of wage earners in America pay 71% of the tax. But here's the deal. Okay, you're running a country, and you have a choice. You can have people that make $20 million a year and pay you $3 million a year in tax. Or you can have people that make $50,000 a year and pay you zero in tax. Or even change it to Obama's mythical world where the people making $50,000 a year are paying $20,000 in tax. Who would you rather have? If you're running a country and you're trying to pay for things, would you rather have the money, the millions of dollars, the $3 million from the Romneys? Or would you rather have the $20,000 from the guy that made $50,000? You know, if you don't understand that the man paid $3 million in tax and therefore made a bigger contribution by a gargantuan margin than other people, than the people listening to that commercial, then you ought not vote. You know, beyond the fact that the only reason his tax was rate was lower was because of capital gains, and capital gains is the mother's milk of economic progress. Without capital gains, there is no economic progress. If you were to eliminate the capital gains reduced rate, we would go instantly into a depression. That's the kind of thing we're playing with here, and no one seems to be able to hold their head above the crowd and say, you know, America, it's time that somebody told you the truth. Here's the truth about the tax system and why it is counterproductive that businesses now in America are burdened with one of the highest tax rates in the world, and why that is not in your interests. And why we need to deregulate business, and why we need to lower the tax rates on business and on the most productive Americans if we're going to have any hope of a prosperous economy. So why is it that a man who has never worked a day in his life in business, who has never built a business, never saved a business, never done anything with regard to a business, has absolutely no business experience, none, is able to create the impression on senseless and irrational Americans that he is better prepared to lead the economy of America than a guy who has invested in business, who has worked in business, who has built businesses, who has saved jobs, who has created jobs, who has raised capital for business. I mean, to be Romney and not turn that into your greatest strength in the middle of a prolonged recession against a totally incompetent and failed administration tells you there's something deeply wrong with Romney's ability to articulate this profound difference. But nonetheless, that is what we have, and it is stunningly sad. Moving on to items in the news, this appeared briefly. We don't want to cover this anymore. I guess we're distracted with other things, but dozens of people were killed, I think three dozen to be exact, were killed in a series of suicide bombings, which means Islamic terrorists, in southwestern Afghanistan yesterday. Senior police officials said that at least four different suicide bombers blew themselves up in public markets, killing mostly women and children. We'll return to the nature of suicide bombings in America, aiding and abetting the deployment of such bombs in Syria. This is Shattering Myths. Shattering Myths, where we expose the misconceptions associated with religion and politics, military and economic schemes. It would be unfair, I think, to have the conversations that Scott and I enjoyed during the break, if we can use the term enjoy anyway, but our conversation during the break if we didn't share it. After all, the purpose of a radio program is not typically for the host and the producer to chat back and forth, but for us to share with you so that hopefully we can open your eyes and have you become better informed and therefore be empowered to make better decisions. Our discussion during the break was over, you know, what is it in this culture that causes so many people to be jihadists, to be suicide bombers? Because we see it pervasively across Islam. 99% of terrorist acts today are perpetrated by fundamentalist Muslims. Why do they do that? And the answer is because of Muhammad. Muhammad, after he was forced out of Mecca in shame, following the satanic verses where he said that there were lots of gods and goddesses that served along with Ar-Rahman and his Lord and with Allah, Alat and Al-Uzza, et al. He was made a mockery of, and then he tried to escape and said, well, he flew on a wild barak, which is a winged ass, to Jerusalem, where he entered the temple, which, of course, had been destroyed some 600 years earlier, and he met with all of the Hebrew bigwigs to talk about God, and then his mighty winged ass leaped up to heaven, passing, by the way, hell on the way, where he saw lots of women hanging by their breasts, being tortured for being ungrateful to their husbands, and he went up through the seven heavens to meet with Allah. He came back with that story, and he was so disgraced and so laughed out of town that he was forced to retreat to Yathrib, which was primarily a Jewish community, but there were some Arabs there, and the first Arabs that he met with, he formed what was called the Pledge of Aqaba, where the now Arabs converted to Islam, pledged to wage war against all humankind. That is a direct quote. So the Muslims went off and they began to find the easiest prey, because they didn't work, because just as Islam has always been a horrible system in terms of productivity, Islam has always been impoverished. The only way that these first Muslims could feed themselves was to become thieves. That's why there was a golden era of Islam. The barbarians robbed all of the surrounding communities and brought gold back and fortunes that others had earned, stolen goods, back with them. That's why the 8th surah of the Quran says that stealing is lawful and good. So they found the easiest prey were Jews, because they were unarmed and they were really good prey, because they were productive and they had assets. And so they began to terrorize Jews and steal their property, steal their homes, exile them, enslave their children, rape their wives. And systematically, Muhammad and his first Muslims attacked the four largest Jewish communities within camel ride of Mecca. But after a while, they had overhunted Jews, that there were no more Jews to rob, to rape, and to enslave. He turned his attention then to neighboring Arabs, who, because they had no armies and were simply traders, were fairly easy to rob as well. And he began to kidnap their children, enslave other children. He began to rob them, rape their women, and kill the men. But after a while, he had overhunted the neighboring Arabs that were within camel ride. So Muhammad, knowing that just like Genghis Khan and Kublai Khan, that after you have led lots of raids and you have created an economy based solely on stealing through terrorist acts, that those terrorists will turn on you if there's no more loot. And so Muhammad recognized he had overhunted Jews. There were no more Jews to hunt. That he had overhunted neighboring Arab and caravans. And so he turned his attention for the first time to a real culture, to the Byzantines, and to an outlying Byzantine community. But the first Muslims, these Mujahideen and jihadists, says, hey, you know, it is one thing for us to go against the defenseless Jews. It's another thing for us to go against these defenseless caravans. But the Byzantines, they have an army. We're not going to go out and play jihad against a real army. We'll get slaughtered. And so they began to rebel. One of the advantages of Prophet of Doom is I put the Quran into the context of Muhammad's life and I reorder it chronologically, so that you find in the 9th surah Allah speaking against these peaceful Muslims who no longer want to play jihad. They no longer want to be terrorists. They no longer want to go off and rob and kill and plunder if they have to go against a real standing army. And they're telling Muhammad, no, we ain't going across the desert to attack a Byzantine community, even if it is a satellite settlement or town. not going to do it. So Allah says, you Muslims who are not willing to fight jihad, who are not willing to kill on my command, not willing to steal on my orders, you are hypocrites. And so all peaceful Muslims in the ninth surah are called hypocrites. And Allah tells the good Muslim jihadists to kill the hypocrites so by himself can torture the peaceful Muslims in the hottest places in hell. That is the nature of this religion. It is what it teaches. The ninth surah was the second to last handed down. Means it cannot be abrogated by anything other than the fifth surah, which was the last handed down. The principal purpose of the fifth surah was to change the nature of Islam's enemy. Islam's enemy was initially Arabs who were part of Muhammad's tribe and family. That changed to become Jews. When Muhammad moved from Mecca to Yathrib, today's Medina, you see all of the surahs become anti-Semitic, and the principal enemy of Muhammad, and therefore his wannabe God, became Jews. But in the fifth surah, after overhunting Jews, the fifth surah exists to change the nature of what is an infidel. They became Christians. And in the fifth surah, the identity of the enemy is now called Christians because Muhammad knew that to keep his mujahideen satiated with their bloodlust and their covetousness, that he'd go have to attack Byzantine communities, which was Christian communities. And then the fifth surah ends by telling Muslims that every Muslim who have questioned their religion has rejected their religion. And, of course, the fourth surah of the Quran says any Muslim who rejects their religion must be killed. That is Islam, my friends. That is why they are jihadists. There's only one guaranteed means to enter the Islamic paradise, and that is to kill for Allah and to die while killing for Allah. It is what the virgins in paradise are there to reward. You may not know it, but when an Islamic suicide bomber screams, Allahu Akbar, Allah is greater, means greater than Yahweh. When they scream that, which is the prayer of fear, that those suicide bombers have wrapped their private parts in gauze so that when they blow themselves up, the appendage that they plan to use to conquer the virgins in the Islamic brothel of paradise will be intact. Now, what one of those is going to do when the rest of your body is blown to smithereens, I have no idea. But religion has never been rational, nor has government. I said after the break that we would transition to not just bombers in Afghanistan, who we claim to oppose, to bombers in Damascus, who we are aiding and abetting. They are the exact same people, exact same allegiance to the exact same religion. And on one side of the border, we're calling them the enemy. And we have troops stationed to fight them. On the other side of the border, they're our allies, and we are providing weapons to them. A bomb exploded in central Damascus on Wednesday near several buildings and a hotel housing UN observers, wounding three people and sending a pillar of black smoke into the sky above the Syrian capital. That bomb was deployed by the very people that the CIA and the U.S. military are now equipping. This occurred exactly 4 weeks after a bomb killed four of President Bashar al-Assad's top security officials, including his brother-in-law. Syrian Deputy Foreign Minister Mikdad told reporters that the scene that the bombing proved, quote, the criminal and barbaric nature of those who carry out these attacks and their backers in Syria and abroad. Guess who is backing them? Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and the United States. Groups calling themselves the Descendants of the Prophet's Brigade and Al-Habib al-Mustafa Brigade. These are just names for one of the many thousands of Islamic Mujahideen clubs fundamentalist Salafist Muslims, said on a Facebook page that they were jointly responsible for the bombing, which they said had killed 50 soldiers. Competing rebel groups often claim attacks, and it is usually unclear who was actually behind them. These aren't competing rebel groups, dear journalist. They're on the same side. The same side as the United States. Not so coincidentally. The fact that they lied about the carnage caused by their bomb, that it blew up a civilian area, a hotel, and killed no soldiers, is just typical of Islam. Assad's troops launched a successful counter-offensive last month against the insurgents. Now, in the case of Syria, the insurgents are on America's side, or America's on the insurgents' side. In the case of Afghanistan, they're on the opposite side, even though they're the same people. They are still trying to dislodge rebels from swaths of Aleppo, Syria's biggest city and its commercial capital. More than 160 people, including 105 civilians, were killed across Syria on Tuesday, an opposition watchdog organization reported. What are you going to call the Mujahideen that have now been armed by Saudi Arabia, by Kuwait, by Qatar, by Bahrain, by the United States? What are you going to call them if they are armed to the teeth and fighting military units? How do you label them civilians? Now, this is Shattering Myths. I am Yada. I would encourage you to call after the break, 877-300-7645. Shattering Myths. We are now going to continue to focus on the misconceptions associated with religion and with military schemes. Today I had hoped to cover a story, and I'll postpone it probably to tomorrow unless there's other news, about the Talmud and the Torah and their relationship to Judaism, because I'd like to dispel the myth that so many Christians have that the Torah is somehow Jewish and that nothing could be further from the truth. So that will be our focus of our news program tomorrow, is a news article that just came out of Israel reemphasizing the importance of the Talmud over the Torah. But since we've been talking about Muslims behaving badly, I want to share some lines from the Quran and Hadith with you so that you understand the motivation for their madness. This is from the 8th Surah. I referenced the 8th Surah in our last segment. It's called The Spoils of War, is the name of the Surah. Let me read to you from that Surah. It says, Allah has sent you from your homes to fight for the cause. Allah wished to confirm the truth by his words. Wipe the infidels out to the last. I shall fill their hearts of these infidels with terror. So smite them on their necks and every joint, and incapacitate them. For they are opposed to Allah and his apostle. Whoever opposes us should know that Allah is severe in retribution. The infidels will taste the torment of hell. So when you meet them in battle, do not retreat. For all who turn away from fighting will bring the wrath of Allah upon themselves, and their abode will also be hell. It was not you who killed them, but Allah who did so. You did not throw what you threw. Allah did, to bring out the best in the faithful. Now, we could spend an hour just on that passage, and maybe in a future show we will, to show you how utterly corrupt, how utterly uncivil the Islamic religion is. But I want to move on and share more of these with you. I would like you now to consider this. This is from Ishaq, page 576. Allah and Muhammad humiliated every coward and made our religion victorious. We were glorified and we destroyed them all. By what our apostle recites in his Quran and from his book and from our swift horses, I liked the punishment the infidels received. Killing them was sweeter than drink. We galloped among them, panting for the spoil. With our loud-voiced army, the apostles' squadron advanced into the fray. Quran 61:4. Surely Allah loves those who fight in his cause. How about Quran 47:4? When you clash with the unbelieving infidels in battle, fighting jihad in Allah's cause, smite them on their necks until you overpower them, killing and wounding many of them. In length, when you have thoroughly subdued them, bind them firmly, making them captives. Thus are you commanded by Allah to continue carrying out jihad against the unbelieving infidels until they submit to Islam. Ishaq, page 315. It was so criminal, men could hardly imagine it. Muhammad was emboldened because of the bloody fighting. I swear we shall never lack for soldiers nor for army leaders. Driving before us infidels, we will subdue them with a halter above their noses and a branding iron. We will drive them to the ends of the earth. We will pursue them on horse and on foot. We will never deviate from fighting in our cause. Any people that disobey Muhammad will pay for it. If you do not surrender to Islam, then you will live to regret it. The first time jihad appears in the Quran, and attached to Quran, the second surah, 190th verse, the publishers of the Nobel Quran, which is the most accurate literal translation of the Quran, wrote this footnote so that readers would understand what the Quranic definition of jihad is. This is what they wrote. Jihad is holy fighting in Allah's cause, with full force of numbers and weaponry. It is given the utmost importance in Islam, and it is one of its pillars. By jihad, Islam is established. Allah's word is made superior, which means that only Allah has the right to be worshipped. And Islam is propagated. By abandoning jihad, Islam is destroyed, and Muslims fall into an inferior position. Their honor is lost. Their lands are stolen. Their rule and authority vanish. Jihad is an obligatory duty in Islam on every Muslim. He who tries to escape from this duty dies with one of the qualities of a hypocrite. I'd encourage you to think about that during this coming break and then join us on the other side. This is Yada and Shattering Myths.
Many Americans suffer from digestive problems, often totally unaware they're not absorbing essential nutrients from foods and supplements. Dr. Peter Glidden is aware of the importance